to ask you first about the man in the boat in Vernon, Florida. I promised my
Coy Brock.
Coy Brock.
Yes.
I promised my friend Robin I would find out first how you did that shot, which is, I think, one of the most beautiful shots in any of your movies before Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. And I want to ask where it is in relation to the film in your mind. Just talk about that shot.
Well, Vernon, Florida was a movie like this current movie that was perceived as a complete disaster. And it became something in editing. Almost everything went wrong in the production of the movie. That's what's so surprising, that people like it so much. You start thinking about something as being a disaster, it's hard later on to dispossess yourself of that notion. It stays with you. And I really didn't know what I was doing. I was confused about the Nub City material, about what kind of movie I was making, what the subject matter should be. But I did like the characters down there. I liked the characters very, very much. Of course, those that were willing to talk to me, there were a whole number of people who refused to talk to me. Very much like the question that was asked last night, people have asked me, well, why aren't there more women in Vernon, Florida? And there aren't more women in Vernon, Florida because the women were too smart. They just refused to talk to me for the most part. It was only the men who were willing to talk. I did this long interview with Coy Brock. I was fascinated by a lot of the religious stuff down there. Coy Brock was one of these homespun philosophers with various interpretations of everything. I filmed him once near his house, and then we took him out on this pond, swampy area filled with cypress, which is not far from Vernon. And he just started talking about this stuff. I always liked the idea of God, that just happened, because it seems like really the antithesis of what we always think God is. God is somehow idea of order, design, control, purpose. And this is kind of almost blind chaos. That just happened. That just happened. Call it God.
And as he says that, he seems to think it is an answer to a complaint of purposelessness.
Yeah, but in fact, it always, in my mind, just reinforces a kind of feeling of senselessness. The senselessness of it all.
How did you do the shot, technically? It's
just, the light was very, very beautiful. We were going in and out of cypress trees. It was late in the afternoon. The light was really, truly lovely. And it's just one of those things in filmmaking where everything works in your favor.
Were you in the boat with the DP?
It should happen, by the way, because so often things, you know, work in your disfavor. You'd like to think just now and then again, it's the other way around.
It's got to be a ledger somewhere. So, were you in the boat with Ned Burgess?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We were all in. I must have been Ned, myself, and Coy. The three of us.
And you shot it on 16mm, 35?
We shot in Super 16.
Super 16.
The whole movie.
So, sync sound in the camera?
Yes. Well, no, there was a tape recorder. Maybe I was doing the recording, I believe.
And you did that for PBS, so you shot at 133?
I shot actually at 166.
Really?
Even though my money has traditionally come from television, I always, in the back of my mind, think this is going to go into theaters, so I should be prepared. The current project that has been commissioned by Channel 4 properly speaking, is something for television, yet I've shot it on Super 16, I've shot it in 166. And looking at the material, there is at least, to me, the possibility that it could become something more than just a TV program.
This is the Temple Grandin Project.
The Temple Grandin Project. So, I always have that as an end in mind. But the characters in Vernon are a strange group. I mean, I like the movie because there is no really identifiable story. Maybe even less so than Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. It's just this assortment of characters trapped in limbo. The growing sand, which I like very much. Sand that grows. It's growing sand.
One of the most chilling moments in any movie I know of is when you've got that tight close-up on the sand, the dog over here, and her voiceover, it grows, it grows, it crawls. But that needed to come near the end because of a certain arc, at least I perceive in there, that moves from a kind of barrage of different perspectives into something that's a lot more troubling, darker. The end of the movie seems darker than the beginning to me. Is that something with the being lost in the woods and all of that? Is that something that you were thinking of as you?
In fact, yes. I mean, these are movies about some kind of hope. A friend of mine whose writing I admire, Ron Rosenbaum, wrote an article about quack cancer therapies. And at the end of the article, he says, well, they probably don't work, but maybe if they do work, they work because people think they might work. And by writing this article debunking quack cancer cures, I'm perhaps removing that possibility. Their effectiveness through hope. And then at the very end of the article he says, no need to worry, because after all, false hope springs eternal. Well, there's another line from Kafka, a story that I read, a conversation between Kafka and his close friend Max Brod. And Max Brod asks Franz, but what about hope? Don't you believe there's hope? And Franz answers, of course, hope, just a world of hope, just not for us.
If you flip that and you think about despair, I think of Dennis White in The Thin Blue Line. In fact, in class, I did my own little re-editing and contrasted Dennis White late in the movie saying, basically, it was out of my control. I thought I should have controlled it. Therefore, I don't do this anymore. I've given up. And then David Harris's response to the car that spins out of control, which is one of a kind of detached glee is too strong, but he's certainly entertained by it in some odd way, and at that moment brings his arm up and you see the handcuffs. So is there a sense in which despair can in fact have more integrity than the kind of perseverance David Harris represents, where he just doesn't let the hopelessness get to him?
Well, I always trust people who are depressed. I always think that depression is something that I'm familiar with and can well understand. Dennis White really was depressed following Adams's conviction because he truly believed in his innocence. and really couldn't understand how such a thing could happen. I think that's ultimately what did him in, is his confidence that good would will out in the end, and that somehow he could be a passive spectator, or a more or less passive spectator to, some passion play, where good triumphs in the end. And one amazing outcome of the movie is that Dennis flew up to Boston to see me with his wife, to tell me how much what I had done had meant to him, and he was going to start practicing law as a result. He was going to take up law again after many years, because what I had done had given him the hope of carrying on. Now, whether that's such a good thing for his clients or not, I can't say.
Interesting when the exposé, or the accurate portrayal of something, actually reverses it. I mean, in a sense, by being utterly faithful to his depression and showing that despair, yet in the service of this larger project of yours, and you, by painting it the way it was, you caused it to change. But not in the sense of tampering with the evidence.
Well, I gave a class at Harvard not so long ago. A friend of mine who teaches there asked me to come and talk to his class about The Thin Blue Line, because they were watching the movie that week. And the class was horrified to hear. I said in the course of talking to the class that day that The Thin Blue Line was a work of propaganda. And I think it is good to remember that it is a movie. I sometimes am dismayed when I hear people say it's the movie that got Randall Adams out of prison, because that's really not quite true. It's my investigation, part of which was done with the movie camera, plus the attention that the movie brought to the case that got him out of prison. It wasn't just hand-waving. It was real investigative, back-breaking, laborious investigative work that went on for years and years. It's important to remember that a movie is a movie, and like any movie, do I claim that this is some absolutely truthful story? No, I don't. In fact, I like to think of it more as a movie about the avoidance of truth, about self-deception, than about how truth can somehow be presented in cinematic form. My version of Godard, that cinema is truth at 24 frames a second. I think cinema is lies at 24 frames a second.
And half of its darkness, right? The way the way Bergman has formulated it. Let me ask you about a moment in A Brief History of Time. For me, one of the most interesting characters in the movie is Roger Penrose, especially as he stands in relation to Stephen Hawking. Two of my favorite moments are Penrose talking about the elation that he feels without knowing why, and later remembers that he had an idea. Then later in the film, he talks about the evidence that seems to exist that consciousness is a measurable fraction of a second elsewhere in time. And since not only questions of epistemology, but questions of the nature of consciousness,
yes,
are working very, very powerfully throughout your work. What do you make of those statements, and where do you think they fit in that particular work, or what implications do they have for...
Well, I felt in the case of Roger Penrose in particular that it was really impossible, not only impossible to provide some kind of faithful account of his work. But even the stuff that appeared in the movie really doesn't do justice to him. And I have learned that he was unhappy with the movie because he felt, not misrepresented, but somehow felt that the movie didn't really give the proper idea of what it is he does. You know, he's written two massive books, on the whole issue, really, of consciousness, the mind, and physics. It's one of his perennial concerns, and it's part of an ongoing debate with Stephen Hawking, part of which appears in a series of talks that they gave at Cambridge University. And there's sections by Roger Penrose, there's sections by Stephen Hawking, and then there are comments on each other's lectures.
Where is that? Is that?
I think it's published by Oxford University Press within the last couple of years. And, you know, a lot of this, you know, comes down to issues in the interpretation of quantum mechanics. Stephen Hawking having one view, Penrose having another. And in many ways, they're antagonists, even though they have been, in some other real sense, collaborators over the years. Not direct collaborators in the sense that they ever work directly with each other, but certainly they have been influenced and inspired by each other's work. Stephen Hawking's first major result was taking a result of Penrose, concerning singularities, you know, turning it around and applying it to the universe. And I've often thought I'd like to do something about that whole issue of consciousness, with or without Penrose, but I'm not exactly sure how I would go about doing it. It's something that crosses my mind now and then again. Certainly it appears in this current movie. Consciousness was put there by God as a way of monitoring us.
Like the baby monitor in the nursery. It was interesting that in a film that is so chronologically marked and yet which works against certain simple direct notions of chronology, like A Brief History of Time, it was interesting to hear Penrose talk about awareness as being free of that. Or
I like that stuff. I really liked it being in the movie. It seemed ironic and twisted at the end. I mean, the movie, and I guess there's always these thoughts about everything I do. I certainly have these thoughts about everything I do. I could have done it better, I could have done this, I could have done that. Interviews with the scientists were really hard to edit. Someone, you know, got it into their heads that I was some kind of a muckraking journalist. I think it was really the occasion of Stephen Hawking's separation from his first wife. And several of the scientists that I talked to had their backs up, as if, like, I will not answer that question, or I will not talk about that, particularly if the area sort of dipped into metaphysics.
Interesting.
As opposed to purely physical concerns. Roger Penrose would be really, really interested to examine in detail about that sort of stuff, but a lot of it is extremely technical, and it's how you sort of tease a movie story. I don't really like displeasing anybody who's been in my movie. I'm not sure how I can really answer Penrose, or even if I should answer Penrose, but I think he works well in the movie, and it was just not the place to provide some more extended section. The movie is coming to an end. Some more extended section about his musings on the mind, brain, consciousness, and so on and so forth. This was described to me as an impossible project, and I think it is an impossible project in the sense that theoretical physics, particularly this kind of theoretical physics, is truly recalcitrant to easy explication. It's not as if you can just in the course of a few seconds or so provide people with enough information so that they can understand some kind of an argument that might be put forth. I used to think of this horrible infinite regress that, you know, you'd put one thing in and then in an attempt to explain it, you would find that something, in fact, in addition had to be explained, and an attempt to explain that, and so on and so forth, until, you know, the movie is hundreds of hours long and there's no one left in the theater. It's just, which has happened to me, by the way. The first screening of Gates of Heaven, it was at the Berlin Film Festival, and there were no subtitles. It was shown in English. The host took me out to have a beer, because I was going to answer questions after the end of the movie, and I came back with him, and the movie hadn't finished. The movie was still playing, but it was playing to a completely empty theater.
But you kept on going.
Maybe it's out of a desire to repeat that experience that I exercise great caution. You know, in the material that I put in a movie.
But time has vindicated you.
I don't know. I mean, Gates of Heaven, I like Gates of Heaven. I can see why for many people it really isn't a movie. It is something different. I truly admire the work of Douglas Sirk, for example. I think Douglas Sirk is a great film director, and there's a whole number of movies that he made that have been very influential, certainly on me and my work. Tarnished Angels, among others, is a truly bleak Hollywood movie. I even think when we had the clown with the skeleton on his back, it reminds me of that scene in Tarnished Angels where suddenly death comes in during Mardi Gras.
I haven't seen that. And the only Sirk I've seen is Imitation of Life, which is
very good, but one of my less favorite Sirk movies.
All right, Tarnished Angels.
Tarnished Angels is shot in black and white scope. It's wonderful if you can actually see it in black and white scope, but it's still wonderful under any circumstances.
It'll work even pan and scan? Okay.
And All That Heaven Allows. Tarnished Angels is really a great movie.
Okay.
And I met Douglas Sirk at the same Berlin Film Festival. This was a series of disasters for me. And I told him how he was certainly one of my favorite filmmakers, if not my favorite filmmaker, and what a great pleasure it was to meet him, and how much I wanted him to see my first movie, Gates of Heaven. And so I induced him and his wife to see the movie, and he kept trying to get up and to leave, and and his wife kept pushing him down. And I kept wishing, my God, just let him go. I mean, if he doesn't want to watch it, it's going to be something that's compulsory. And, you know, he told me that this is not a movie, this is a slideshow. So, yes, that's true. There's sort of like the idea that movies should be one thing rather than another. Maybe it's because I've gotten older and more worn out, or more able to convince myself to the contrary. I take some pride in the fact that these movies really don't look like other movies, that they are really different in character. It also interests me that they're vastly imitated. They're copied by people. And a lot of what looked so odd or so unique or so novel now seems less so, particularly in the case of the Thin Blue Line, because it's been imitated so widely. It's become almost kind of a stylistic text on how to tell certain kinds of stories. Fast, cheap, I don't know what the ultimate result will be, but I like to think that it too is a movie really unlike other movies. It's strange. Part of me would like to, you know, be just like all the other kids on the block and be making movies that are like other movies. But part of me, I think, also resists that. Either consciously or unconsciously. I would like the films to work as cinema. I don't want them to be boring. I don't want them to be prosaic. I want them to be exciting. And I think there's a way of introducing some odd combination of real drama and documentary. I'd like to make an effort to do that in this next project, this Mac project, where I could create some kind of hybrid. And what that means, I'm still not altogether sure, although I have the same strong feeling as I had with the Hawking movie, that if this is a movie about science explication, it will be a disaster. Or it will have no content.
Right.
Probably both. And, you know, if it's a movie just simply that is a biographical piece about Stephen Hawking, I will certainly have Stephen Hawking's enmity as a result. And it, too, will somehow not be all that interesting. It seemed to me that it had to be a combination of those two elements. Same is true with the John Mack material. I'm not just simply interested in hearing endless stories about people being abducted by one alien after another. There have been plenty of people that have done that. I am interested in John Mack's obsession with alien abduction and how he became drawn into this very strange world. A world that most people would characterize as pseudoscience. And yet there's something to John Mack and to the sincerity of his approach that makes you wonder what exactly is going on here. I like to think for a movie to work, there still has to be an investigative element. If I knew everything there was to know about the subject matter before going into it, then why make the movie?
Right. It would be a report.
Yeah, it's a term paper rather
than
a movie.
Right, that's right.
And most Hollywood movies nowadays seem like term papers. They seem like really good term papers in many instances, but term papers, formulaic, predictable. And so I take some comfort in thinking that at least I'm doing something that is different. And that has something to do with me. It's at least my attempt to explain to myself and others who it is I am.
Let me ask you some questions about
the
chronology of Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, just to make sure I've got its making, the narrative of its making straight in my mind. You began shooting the principal interviews. How long ago?
I have to tell the truth now. I started shooting, they're all shot in 3 days.
Okay.
In a studio in Boston in 1992.
Okay.
And they were shot in the summer. And I shot first The Electric Chair Repairman, and also I might add Holocaust Revisionist, Fred Lucher.
That's a full plate.
Yes. A plate that, by the way, has caused considerable trouble in getting the material financed, as though people somehow couldn't make that disconnection that I could make a movie about a Holocaust revisionist without being one.
Ah.
I would actually have to tell people on the phone, I am not a Holocaust revisionist. I am a Jew. I was bar mitzvahed. I believe the Holocaust happened.
That's interesting. That's a tough leap for people to make when their emotions are so fiercely engaged.
Yes. And in the end, I decided not to try to make this as a feature film. Even though I think that the issues raised by Fred, these are not issues about whether the Holocaust happened. That I put to rest many, many years ago. They're issues about sort of, again, like the discussion in this previous class, on his underlying motivation. Why is he saying these things? It's another essay, if you like. It's the ultimate essay on untruth. True believers in lies.
Right.
What is their position with regard to this? How did they wander into this strange landscape? Is he an anti-Semite? What does being an anti-Semite mean? Why is he saying these things? Does he even believe what he's saying? Is he a tool of other people? But it went into this kind of... It's very interesting because I first heard about... And you have to tell me when I'm just not answering these questions and going off in some ridiculous, unproductive manner.
I'll jump in.
But Fred appeared on the front page of the New York Times, top half of the page, right underneath the New York Times, and there is the headline, "Can Capital Punishment Be Humane?" You know, whether or not that's an oxymoron, I leave for others to decide. And there's Fred's smiling face. And there's an article about his role servicing, designing, execution machinery. By the way, a self-styled designer of execution machinery without any real background in engineering or anything else that would qualify him for this particular role.
Interesting self to invent.
Interesting self to invent, yes. An invented self. And the New York Times ran this article, and at the very, very, very end of the article, buried in some back page, they mention in a line or two, oh, he also happens to be a Holocaust revisionist.
Interesting.
Now, of course, this drew the ire of many, many, many Jewish organizations that felt, I don't think without foundation, by the way, that the New York Times had acted terribly irresponsibly by printing an article about this man without addressing this other fundamental role that he was playing at the time. If only for the reason that it gave him this veneer of respectability that he did not deserve. My project was to be different. It was to delve deeply into that connection between capital punishment and Holocaust revisionism. It was to be the center, the crux of the deal.
And that was going to be part of Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control?
No, it never was going to be. It was part of my arguments with Corwin, who is now Stone's editor, who felt very strongly that Fred had to be put in with the other four. And I said, I just don't want to talk about this anymore. No, 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 and no.
For a while, you were going to have the rogue elephant electrocution as part of the story. But then the robotics story was the last one that you added. I mean, is that finally made the four?
Yes.
The four.
I mean, I sort of looked at it as like a dinner party. That and it always became a joke about inviting Fred to a dinner party. And what is it that you do? But the idea of putting George together with this guy seemed to me just unseemly. It seemed unconscionable. There was just no question about it. It was never, as far as I was concerned, there was never an issue about whether or not he should go in the movie. He should not. And I've never really thought otherwise. Lucha is his own deal, for better or for worse. Bob Richardson also shot a lot of the Lucha material, and it's really quite stunning looking. Because of his role as a revisionist and the controversy that has been generated around him, he lost most of his work with the various prisons in the United States, and most of the wardens don't want to have anything to do with him. They don't want to be associated with him, and they most certainly do not want to be photographed with him. So we brought him down to Tennessee, to Nashville, and he installed a new electric chair system in the prison outside of Nashville. And the warden wouldn't even come out to greet us. For whatever reason, he allowed us in, but they locked us in with Fred in the death chamber all day long. So, you know, we could not photograph him with either the warden himself or with any other prison personnel. And we did some photography with him there that is quite striking.
And where is that footage, and will we see it?
I plan to deliver it to Channel 4 as one of these four new television shows. There'll be a half hour about Fred, half hour about Temple Grandin, half hour about Sandra London, and a half hour about Saul Kent, who is a cryonics expert who dismembered his mother, had her head frozen for future resuscitation, and then was asked to turn the head over for autopsy because foul play was suspected. Refused to turn the head over. As he put it, he fled with the head. Yeah, he absconded with the head.
Wow.
And that's the fourth story. I took the title from an old horror movie, I Dismember Mama.
The responsible thing for me to do would be to take you to your next class. I would dearly love to do the irresponsible thing and flee with the director.
Well, maybe afterwards we have time.
There's the reception at Trench Hill. Somebody else is interviewing you. I have a faculty meeting to go to.
I try not to look at the schedule. I feel it should be shared with me on a need-to-know basis.
I think that's probably wise. I want to tell you a couple of things very quickly about Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control. One of the great pleasures, and I think it's even more intense with that film than with any of your other films I've ever shared with my friends, is how intense and really loving the conversation almost immediately becomes when we talk about that movie together.
Really?
Yes.
That's really nice to hear.
I noticed it last night. I noticed it with my friend Robin. We saw it together a couple of nights ago. I noticed it with my wife when we first saw it. I noticed it with a friend of mine who's a creative writing teacher in the department. I hope you can meet at the reception today, Hank Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the great gifts of that movie, I think, as you have made it, that not only does it get people talking excitedly about the stuff you do as you begin to think your way through the way it's structured, but what we feel has been shared with us, we want very much to share with each other.
The greatest worry I have about that movie is that I have worked on it for so long, and I have so many ideas about it and what I have done. I wonder whether I have projected much of this on material that may be inchoate and vague. It was strange after the Sundance screening. It was almost like some weird spin control. I got up and I talked after the movie for about an hour, and there were a lot of people in the auditorium as an effort to try to define this movie. I hope not in any kind of pedantic sense, but I was just going on and on and on and on and on in some anecdotal form. And then reviews came back. There was a review written by a friend of mine, Todd McCarthy for Variety, which was a rave.
Mm-hmm. I saw that.
Despite the fact that he said something about the movie having no heart, that's one thing that I would disagree with.
Me too.
Because I think the movie does have heart. I think that's one thing I think is there. But a friend of mine asked, now, did he think this himself, or did he listen to what you said after the movie? And it's a worry that somehow the movie needs me as director explicator to appear afterwards to provide some kind of instructional manual for its viewer.
Let me just say this. That's an unanswerable question.
I know.
But I can tell you...
It's the paranoid concern of the day.
Well, all I can tell you, and just put this in when God is playing dice with the universe where you can't see it. I'd never met you. I hadn't read anything about the movie. The thing came in from your assistant. I watched it. It was immediately apparent to my wife and to me that it was both wonderfully self-reflexive and wonderfully generative out of itself at the same time. And we just marveled at that. And every time I've seen it, my conviction about that has grown stronger. I don't mean to be uncritical, because if I'm uncritical, then you won't believe my praise.
No, but I mean, it's nice. It actually is very, very nice to hear. It is. I mean, it's something that I worry about.
I feel very strongly about that. And thank you for giving that to us.
Well, thanks for showing it.
It's my pleasure.